Well, summer is a time of fresh ingredients and amazing flavors. And while it's a short season, it's, I think, arguably the best time of the year for food. So if you want to extend the bounty of summer well into the rest of the year, you should try canning and preserving. Larry Mueller here again. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our next guests have written a new cookbook that teaches the techniques necessary to preserve food, as well as sharing some great recipes along the way, including one for mint and chili sweet pickled rhubarb. Oh, it looks so good. We have that up on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. They were kind enough to give us permission to do that. Beth Dooley and Maida Nielsen, join us now. And they are the authors of Savory Sweet, Simple Preserves from a Northern Kitchen. And I hope you'll join in the conversation with your questions about preserving, and maybe you've got some ideas of your own. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Beth, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
Oh, and Maida, welcome to you as well. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I have had a lot of fun looking through this this book, and I was thinking about a friend of mine who uses, I think, some techniques that are similar to the kinds of techniques that you use. She gathers raspberries and freezes the raspberries, and at Christmas time, she makes the simple raspberry jam, which is just wonderful, and what a treat to get at Christmas.
Yes, indeed. And that's, you know, the fun thing about the simple preserves is that you don't have to do it in season. You can freeze what you've harvested or even buy good quality frozen fruit and make the preserves at Christmas time or on that dull January afternoon when you need a little bit of summer in your kitchen, right?
Right. And Beth, you start the book by saying, let's dispense with the usual old notions of preserving, and maybe tell us about that. It's friend is.
I'm so jealous of these people that can put up quarts and quarts of tomato sauce. But we don't need to do that anymore, right? We don't need to stock our basements or our root cellars with food through the wintertime because we're not survivalists. And preserving should be fun and lighthearted and something that doesn't take hours and hours. So we, Meta and I, decided to figure out how to simplify the process. So that we're not doing that water bath, that we're cooking things quickly and putting up small batches that can be stored in the refrigerator or the freezer to have on hand to spark up simple meals.
Yeah, and Meta, do you see that your heritage reflected in the preserving that you do?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think Scandinavian sensibility is like, it comes into, we like things to be really simple, and we don't have a lot of space. So I kind of like took all that into account. And also a lot of people nowadays, they don't grow tons and tons of foods. You know, maybe you live in an urban area or you just don't like to grow foods, but you shop at a farmer's market, at a co-op or a grocery store. And while traditional canning recipes are great, but you need access to a lot of produce to do that. So we don't think people are going to go out and buy 30 pounds of tomatoes at a farmer's market. That would be really expensive. But you can buy 3 pounds and you can make, you know, a lot of the recipes. So it kind of came out of that practical sense of doing things.
Yeah, and you're not using the traditional, you know, pectin and so forth.
Not at all, not at all. And actually, all you need to do, like freezing berries actually reduces a little bit of the natural pectin, but you can add in an acid, so a little bit of cider vinegar or lemon juice, or one of my favorite is actually grapefruit juice. It adds like a really complex flavor to things. And you don't add a whole lot, but it just brings a different level of flavor to it. So throw in some grapefruit juice with the raspberry jam next time you make it. It's fun.
And I like how you two have you started your book. You've got some the techniques and sort of the new approaches to making, and It is pretty straightforward.
It's really straightforward.
Yeah. And one of the things we discovered is that when you don't water bath the jars, in other words, you know, that's the typically the end process when you're preserving foods so you can make them shelf stable. Well, because we're not making these jars to be able to live on your pantry shelf at room temperature, these are meant to be refrigerated, we reduce the cooking time, and we're also cutting down on the amount of time that happens when you water bath them, because you're actually re-cooking that food when you water bath it for 15 or 20 minutes. So you've already taken something that's really bright and fresh tasting, cooked it once, and then you're cooking it again when you do that water bath process. This way you end up with a preserve that's really bright and fresh tasting. And the other thing, and I'm going to let Meta talk about using the 10-inch saute pan, because that cuts down on the cooking time as well and makes for a very fresh, you know, end result. So Meta, talk about the
Let's hear from that, Meta.
Yeah, well, I use a 10-inch saute pan for so many things in my cooking, and as I started to, like, look at traditional recipes, and I tried to make them, like, in a saucepan, nothing was working, and I realized the main thing you need to do is you need all the water, the moisture in the fruit to evaporate, and the larger the cooking surface you have, and the shallower it is, the faster it all happens. And so I think some of the, like, the raspberry jam, it takes 15 minutes from you put the berries in there till you have a final jam, and you know, I think that's pretty easy and convenient to do that, but it also tastes so much better because of that. And the other thing we've discovered, when you don't worry about like traditional canning, you can add in a lot of fresh herbs, which really add a lot of flavor, and you can change out the herbs to the ones that you really like, because you're not worried about the pH level of everything. You can refrigerate, but also freeze it. I have things in my freezer that sometimes live there for 3 years. And we do it in those, you know, traditional mason jars. And because it has been in this environment where no oxygen can get in, it is fresh tasting even 3 years later. So, you know, that's, if you left that on the shelf, you know, water bath and put on a shelf in your basement, it would look really nasty after 3 years, and it would have faded and it would have not been inviting. But this way you can bring it out and people think you made it a week ago.
You know, and you do talk, there's, you have so many cool tips in there. There is a point involving a wooden spoon handle that I thought was pretty cool, because you have to cook things down. And I do, you know, you get this in a lot of recipes where I'll cook this halfway down, and you need to do that for some of your recipes. Explain that wooden spoon handle.
Go ahead, Meta, because you discovered it. It's very cool.
Right. Yeah, well, and I kind of call it the dipstick method. It's like how you check the oil in your car, you know. You put it in, you see where the level is, and then you add something. But, you know, of course, this, you have no preset, you know, measurements. But you just, as you put the liquid, so the fruit or whatever it is, in your pan, you put the wooden spoon, or it could be, you know, a wooden skewer or anything in there, and just hold it straight up and down. And you just mark how high the level is with a little pencil. It's hard to see if it's a clear, like when you're using, like, you know, pear juice or something, but, you know, a dark red juice is really easy. And then as you start cooking it, you just check it several times, and it's, you know, it's not a scientific method. You just eyeball it. But it is a lot closer than, like, I have no idea how much was in there if you didn't check the measurement before. So, again, it's my Scandinavian practicality. It's like, I got to find a solution for this. So how I came up with it.
Or Scandahoovian, as they're sometimes called here in Wisconsin. Oh, my God. Well, you know, another one that caught my eye, and I had, you know, there's times, you know, I always have all different kinds of salt. I've got kosher salt, and I have sea salt, and then I have regular iodized salt. And you had a little explanation of why you don't use iodized salt.
Well, you know, it can make things cloudy for starts. And we found that the sea salt has a cleaner flavor. And, you know, it does have a little bit of mineral in it, which is actually better for you. We're not using a ton of salt. A lot of canning books recommend using canning salt, which has an anti-caking agent in it that
that isn't, oh, I'm sorry, doesn't have that anti-caking agent in it, which most commercial salts have.
Yeah.
Sea salt doesn't have it, but if you were to buy, say, just a regular table salt, it probably has an anti-caking agent in it. So the reason why a lot of the canning books specify a canning salt is to avoid that caking agent. Well, if you're using sea salt, that doesn't have a caking agent in it, so there's no reason to go out and buy a special salt to can, is kind of our message. In fact, there's no reason to go out and buy anything special for this book, because
exactly.
You can just do it spur of the moment.
And you were going to add something in there, Meta.
Yeah, it's actually, if you live in an urban area, it's actually difficult to find the canning salt. I found that. because it's just not what a lot of people are using. So, again, it's like use what you would use in your regular cooking, and I happen to be using sea salt, so that's why I'm using. And also the texture, I know table salt is really fine. So if you a teaspoon of table salt versus a teaspoon of sea salt is very different. You will get a lot more, you know, saltiness from the table salt. So, you know, that's why we are just, you know, if you want to use some of those, you can, but you should really, you know, taste things. You know, just be aware that the finer the salt, the more salt is actually physically in a teaspoon.
You know, your book is called Savory and Sweet, but you do emphasize that these recipes do not feature a lot of sugar. And then people would say, how do you achieve the sweetness then?
Well, there are a couple of things that happened. I mean, one, that was intentional, because when we looked at the, other canning recipes and preserving recipes, we're like, wow, that is a ton of sugar. Number one, if you're using really good ingredients, they're probably already pretty flavorful, so the sugar just masks things up. Number two, when you're using huge quantities, it's harder to get the more reduced jammy nature without adding sugar. So when you're using smaller quantities and cooking things more quickly, you're retaining more flavor and you don't need to add sugar to bounce things up. And number three, I think probably a lot of those old recipes called for a lot of sugar because the fruit wasn't completely ripe or it didn't taste that good.
Yeah.
So, you know,
and it was also
go ahead.
No, it was also to preserve it. You know, in order for it to be safe to be sitting on the shelf, you needed to have that much sugar in there. But we are not worried about it being shelf stable. So,
well, I tell you what, this is so much fun. Having a great time here with our two guests, Meta Nielsen and Beth Dooley. They are the authors of Savory Sweet, Simple Preserves from a Northern Kitchen. Lots of great ideas in it. If you have a question for them, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about canning and preserving and kind of, you know what, doing it the easy way and winding up with some really good tasting preserved items. And our two guests, Meta Nielsen, and Beth Dooley, our guests today, and they are the authors of Savory Sweet, Simple Preserves from a Northern Kitchen. I'd love to hear from you, too. Maybe you enjoy canning or preserving at home, or have some secrets and tips you could share, or maybe just some questions about canning and preserving. Give a call. Number's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And you know what? There's a Jerry from Waukesha has a question, and let's go right there. Hi, Jerry. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I was just wondering, actually it is afternoon, asparagus is coming up in my patch now, and of course it's going to all come at once. I was just wondering, is there a simple way to kind of preserve it? I see people that pickle it, of course, but I like pickles just fine, but I'm not really a fan of it in my asparagus. I was wondering, is there a way to make it with just like a salted spring water or something like that to keep it for later use?
All right.
Okay, you want to take that?
Well, I guess I don't really know that, but that's an interesting thought. I think that it might just start rotting, though, if you just put it in a salt water. I'm not sure that it would. I think the vinegar is what would keep it stable. But so what we did, we have a pickled asparagus recipe, and we added some other flavors to it. We added some hot peppers and tarragon, and I have a jar in the refrigerator that's close to a year old now, and I just opened it, and it is incredibly crunchy. So it tastes very different than, you know, pickled cucumbers, but I think you have to use some vinegar. I don't think it would stay. I guess I don't know, but my guess would be it would not stay safe if you just put it in water.
You know, the thing that I like about your recipe for that, as I remember it, is that you don't really cook that asparagus.
We just put the asparagus raw in the jar, and then we pour the hot brine over it. So it's a different texture. I think a lot of it, otherwise, they get really soft, but these stay really crunchy.
Yeah, it stays crunchy, and so actually, and you know what? If I don't know if you like Bloody Marys or not, but those are awfully good in a Bloody Mary as a stir.
Yeah, well, I was wondering about that because about the only time I wind up with pickled asparagus is in a Bloody Mary these days. And I thought, you know, when I saw that crunchy, I thought, well, you know, that can, you can have that in there instead of celery.
Well, exactly. The other thing you can do with these is because they do stay a little bit crunchy, and yet they're par cooked, they're tender crisp, is to chop them and throw them into a salad. It's great in, say, a salad niçoise, or they're wonderful tossed with like a pasta salad because they add that little bit of tang. And then because the brine, and this is true of all the pickle brines that we have, is kind of a seasoned vinegary flavor, you can use that brine as a vinegar and whisk it into a little oil, olive oil or a nut oil, and you have a really nice dressing without having to add too much else to make a vinaigrette.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, super simple.
So, Jerry, there you go.
But maybe we'll have to try and we'll experiment and see if we can do something just with a salt brine. It's interesting. I like that idea, though.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Well, you can join in, too, by the way, 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Barb in Nakusa next. Hi, Barb.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I make a hot pepper jam, and the flavor is real good, except it's a little bit too sweet. And it seems like I've tried cutting the sugar down, and when I do that, it's too runny. It won't stay solid. Do you have any suggestions for that?
I think try and do it in the saute pan. Like, try and cook it in a larger surface, you know, because you need some evaporation. Because I think that would help. We have been cutting sugar so drastically with all of it. So, but also add a little bit of acid into it. Again, a little bit of, you know, the vinegar or lemon or lime juice or something like that. But I think if you cook it in, you know, 10 or larger in saute pan, depending on how big of a quantity you have, I think it might get solid.
And you have some ways, I remember from the book, some ways of, you know, you don't want your jam to be, you know, really runny, but there are ways that you can sort of test, okay, have I gone far enough here? Is it
exactly
thick enough and so forth? Meta, maybe you can comment on that.
Yeah, it's like I used to call it, you know, the parting of the Red Sea kind of thing. So but when people haven't made jams before, when you are cooking it, it's hot, it's still actually very runny. And you think, oh, my goodness, I need to continue to cook this. But you usually don't. So the way we test these for doneness, a set test, as we call it, is we start out by putting a small plate in the freezer when we start cooking. And then after the amount of time that we are recommending, we take the pan off the stove, and then we pour a little bit onto this frozen plate and put it back in the freezer for a couple of minutes. And then run a finger through that kind of cold now jam or whatever it is you're trying. And if it stays apart, that is, or however it runs together, but that is an indication of what it will be like when it's completely cold. So it's not, again, 100% foolproof test, but it gives you an idea. You could just put it back in the stove, cook it a little bit longer. But it's actually a pretty accurate way of what the final result will be. And again, just that little bit, a tablespoon of some kind of vinegar or citrus juice can help with that set. It pulls out the existing pectin and it binds with the sugar. And I'm not a scientist. I don't understand all the exact stuff that's happening, but it works.
Yeah, and Barb, do you are you in a position where you can make small quantities as Meta was suggesting?
Yeah, I'll do that because I've made huge batches, and I liked the texture, but what I didn't like it how sweet it was, and every time I cut the sugar down, it got too runny.
Ah, okay. Well, give that a try and see how it works.
You know. I will.
Yeah, one more trick is to add maybe just an apple peel to the mixture.
Oh.
Because there is pectin, natural pectin, in the apple peel. And while we don't recommend using pectin in the, the jellies, in fact, we don't have any jellies in this book, because I find pectin really tricky to work with, if you throw an apple peel in it, and then you can take it out before you put the jam or put the... put the jelly in a jar. That might also help it come together and make it less runny.
Wow, that's
a very good idea.
So just try it.
That's a great idea. Thanks a lot, Barb, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Love to hear from you. You know, this is kind of rhubarb season coming along here now, and you have this recipe for mint and chili sweet pickled rhubarb in your book, and you were kind enough to let us put it up on our Facebook page. But talk about that recipe. It really sounds good. And
it's great.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Beth, you want to talk about it?
Well, I love it because it's so darn quick, and the rhubarb stays... Again, most rhubarb I've experienced usually gets a little stringy and kind of slimy when it's cooked down. And so this retains the texture. It has texture that's a little more like celery because rhubarb's really a vegetable. And so by preserving it this way, you end up with a really tangy pickle that's delicious paired with cheese or charcuterie. It's wonderful, again, if it's chopped up a little more finely and tossed into a chicken salad, perhaps with wild rice, or served alongside a chicken breast. It's a nice condiment. Meta, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, but put it on a lamb burger or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a really nice texture and flavor. And use, like, the really, thin rhubarb. I wouldn't recommend, there's certain varieties that get really, thick and more woody, and I don't think that would work really well. But the early rhubarb is just so tender. So mm-hmm. it's just, and again, you can change the flavors, put in some other herbs if you like, other herbs better. These recipes are just kind of suggestions. You could mix it up to the way you like it.
You know, one of the cool things I saw in your book was, as you were talking about rhubarb, what did you say? You said the wide foot is the sweetest, juiciest, and most tender part of the rhubarb. And I was thinking, well, the foot, that's white. When I put
it depends on the variety. I think.
Okay.
I grow four different varieties in my garden, and there's hundreds of varieties. But mine are like nice and pink, and they're just really we kind of cut. So there's a little thin thing. We can do like a little diagonal cut, but otherwise keep that in there. And it just there's so much color and sweetness in that part. So, and again, I just like not to throw too many things out. So,
well, dumb me.
No, there are some people I have found out, and I didn't know that, they actually cut their rhubarb. They don't pull the stalks, and I have just never done that. I think actually the plant benefit from you pulling it because I think it signals that it should start producing more.
Well, yeah, you're right. But then when I get the rhubarb out, I was always cutting off the end, which is apparently of the mistake that I should not have. Oh, my goodness me. I get myself into all kinds of things here. But I learn a lot on this show, so I'm going to be a lot smarter when it comes to cutting up that rhubarb. But it's, you know what? We haven't really talked about the organization of the whole book. I've been jumping around here from one thing to the next. And, you know, Beth, maybe you can do this. Talk about how your book is organized.
Well, we sort of followed the organizational pattern that we used for Minnesota's Bounty, the Farmer's Market Cookbook, which took each different item separately, so, you know, and organized them alphabetically. So A is for apples and, you know, uh-huh. and on and on and on, or asparagus, and separating the fruits from the vegetables. And we did that for several reasons. One, because when we preserve, it's out of the need to deal with too much of one or two things. So if Meta has tons of rhubarb or raspberries coming out of her garden and I've perhaps overbought apples or asparagus from the farmer's market, for instance, I really just want to know what to do with that particular item. I don't want to have to wade through an index looking for those items because most preserving books are organized according to jams or jellies or marmalades that way. And so this way, you look at the item and you know exactly what to do with it. Doing that allowed us to then also sort of talk a little bit about the different characteristics of that particular item. So as Meta said, you know, the asparagus stay really crisp, and we wanted to preserve that crispness. We wanted to preserve that bright color. We wanted to share information on what to do once you've pickled the asparagus or with the bean dip, for instance, once you've made that bean dip. So it allowed us that sort of a different approach to what to do with these particular items. And the other thing we acknowledged in writing both of these books is we don't really live by four seasons anymore because our weather is so wacky. So we can experience 80-degree temperatures in the middle of March, for instance, and then really cold temperatures in July. And so our crops are a little bit mixed up. And that plus the very beginning of the summer is nothing like the end of the summer. You have different things. So trying to organize a book also by seasons, I think, makes it difficult to figure out what to cook when. So to simplify things and to make it easy for the cooks and also to make it easy for us as we worked through all of these different items, we wanted to create a book that was as useful as it possibly could be. I mean, our hope is, as beautiful as this book looks, that
once you
get going with it, it's a very pretty book, but once you get going with it, those pages are going to be sticky and, you know, there's going to be splatters all over the place because we want this book to come into the kitchen and get used. Maybe there'll be some dirt on the edges when you're out, you know, in the garden picking something. So that was our intent.
You know, as you were talking, I was just thinking about CSA.
Yes.
You know, and thinking, you know, what this would be, you know, I have friends who say, well, what the heck am I going to do with this? Or I've got, you know, you get surprises every week in a CSA package. Sometimes you know the vegetables and fruits, and sometimes you're not as familiar. And I think in your book, you have some discussion about how you can preserve, preserve a lot of different things, almost anything, right?
Pretty much anything. I mean, there are Go ahead,
Meta.
No, I mean, we really tried to do a lot of things with root vegetables, and we have all kinds of other ideas with it. But that's one of the things that you often get, you know, towards, you know, the late summer in your CSA boxes. So we have, like, a parsnip relish, and we have carrot jam marmalade. And just trying to make, and I was just going to say before when Beth was talking about the book, like, we're really trying to, the savory sweet, you know, we're taking vegetables kind of in a slightly sweet direction, and we're taking fruit in a kind of a more savory direction. So we're really kind of crossing all kind of boundaries with these things. And just to make it more fun, instead of just always making the same thing with the same fruit or vegetable. So, and you can pickle, obviously, a lot of things, but we're having a lot of fun. And again, the idea that you can substitute things in there. I mean, I really want to try and make, like, beet marmalade. I mean, there's just so many other things you can do. So we'll have more books coming.
And, you know, here we are. Wisconsin is the leading producer of cranberries in the in the world, I think. And I was happy to see, and I have never had a cranberry jam, and you have a cranberry jam in the book, rustic cranberry strawberry jam with lime and vanilla, and that sounded really good to me.
It's delicious, and that's a complete surprise, because one of the things, actually that was one of Meta's recipes, and one, I should let you talk about it, Meta, but what I loved about it was that you can, you know, combine things from two different seasons. So if you happen to have fresh cranberries in the fall, which are very, very tart, they pair beautifully with these summery fruits that maybe you have frozen from, you know, picking some at a pick your own or from the farmer's market or your backyard garden, or maybe just finding good quality frozen fruit and then wanting to put it into the jam. You can do that, and vice versa. In the summertime, sometimes those fruit preserves get really too sweet. So if you add something like cranberries, which is a little bit acidic and tart, you have a balance of flavors.
Yeah, and you know, I usually I'll buy cranberry, the bags of cranberries in the fall, because there are tons of them on the markets, and then I throw some bags in the freezer anyway, because I actually crush up a handful of frozen cranberries and throw them on when I'm making pancakes, because they go really good on pancakes. But right. I'm thinking, you know, I could make this.
And the pickled cranberries are really fun. And again, those you can make both with fresh and frozen. I've tried both. And it just adds a nice flavor, you know, a different flavor to the Thanksgiving table, you know, with a traditional cranberry sauce. It's just, you know, again, the pickling with it, it's great with cheeses. And actually, another thing that Beth and I have been working on is making different mustards. And I made a mustard where I used some of the pickled cranberries in there. And it was quite fun. So start out just freezing the cranberries when you have an abundance of them. And then later on, you can start pickling them. You can make mustard. You can do all kinds of stuff.
And you do have some mustards in the book. There's a honey mustard recipe, for example. And the smoked paprika and horseradish mustard.
Oh, it's really good.
Is it good? I bet it is.
It's really good, and it's pretty. And the nice thing about mustards is they're ready in minutes. I mean, all you do is soak the seeds, and then you just whiz them in the food processor with whatever flavors you want to add, and you have a perfect last-minute hostess gift or something to set out with a cheese plate or charcuterie, or if you're grilling this weekend for Memorial Day, you know, you've got all these fun, fancy mustards that look like you spent a fortune when, in fact, it's just taken a couple of minutes and not very much at all.
I think sometime you should invite me to your homes for a sampling of a lot of these. There's so many.
Well, it's so much fun. And that's one of the things about, you know, these recipes is I've worked on like bread making books or cookie books or something. And, you know, it can be really grueling work, as funny as that sounds, because by the end of the day, you've tested 85 different versions of that chocolate chip cookie or oatmeal cookie or whatever, and you never want to see another chocolate chip cookie again. But these are so light and fresh and delicious that you can just keep making them and tasting them, and you feel great. They're so healthy.
You know, we started talking about I mentioned the friend that makes the raspberry jam, and your minty raspberry jam really sounded appealing to me, and I might surreptitiously drop this recipe in her.
Oh, good idea.
in a letter, but I won't put my own. I won't tell her where it's from, but I will just say, here's a minty raspberry jam recipe that a lot of people have tried and seem to like very much, and might be possible to do something about. That come Christmas time, and as you say, like these, you can throw them in the freezer if you're not doing the hot water bath and everything, and if you've got room in your freezer, these things can last a long, long time.
Well, they can, and in a way, we almost resisted the term preserving because
I can see why.
I mean, you're really
you're really transform. It's a difficult, not a difficult concept, but it's really very simple. You're just taking food that you have maybe too much of or that you're excited about, and you're transforming the flavors to save them for another use.
This has been...
So it's really just an extension of cooking.
Yeah. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I hope we have a chance to visit again. Thank you so much for taking time, Beth and Meta, to be with us today. Really appreciate it. Beth Dooley and Meta Nielsen, wasn't that fun? They're co-authors of Savory Sweet Simple Preserves from a Northern Kitchen. We've got a link on our Facebook page. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. They always do a wonderful job, and this is really a beautiful book, and you're going to have a lot of fun with it. Just to look ahead tomorrow, Garden Talk, my old friend Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery joins us. Stay with us. In the meantime, what's in store?